So it's again a tremendous zchus for me to be able to be here again, talking to a group of people who are right now busy toiling with Yom Tov preparations, and nonetheless they found the time to come and hear a little bit about what's required in terms of preparing the house for Yom Tov, in terms of shopping, and to understand what might be some of the differences about some of the things that we see in the marketplace, all sorts of different statements and declarations and certifications that maybe we're less familiar with year-round, what they mean when we see them in the store at this time of year. Is it something that we're comfortable purchasing, not comfortable purchasing? Who is it okay for? Who is it not okay for? Etc. In the booklets, I see that they passed out a sheet. I think there is one available that has a little bit more on it already, on our website. This was the original one, and since then we've added a few sections in terms of how to kosher and clean different items for Pesach. Just to give a very general overview on koshering, there's two basic types of koshering for most intents and purposes, which are subdivided into each one into two subgroups. Those two types of koshering are Hagalah, which is in water. The Pasuk tells us, Kol Asher B'mayim Yavo B'mayim, Kol Asher Bo'esh, anything that was welded in fire, Yaviru Bo'esh, should be passed through fire. So the second type is what we refer to as Libun, which is heating up with fire. The first section of Hagalah is most generally subdivided into two subsections of Hagalah, where you purge the item by immersing it into boiling water. And the latter form is pouring boiling water, again with particular conditions, onto a surface to perform a similar idea of being able to purge out the chametz. And Libun would be taking a blowtorch or heating something up to very high temperature just from any other type of heating element. And it's subdivided into what we've referred to as Libun Kal and Libun Chamor. Libun Kal, meaning a lower level of heat, which is required, and Libun Chamor, which is a higher level of heat that is required. So obviously, we see that both of these types of achsharos are subdivided into what seems to be a more massive form of that achshara and a more minor form of that achshara. So logic would dictate, without too much explanation, that it has to do also with the type of use, whether it had what we would view as maybe more of a massive use or more of a minor use. Now, those aren't massive and minor in terms of volume, but in terms of the sort, the type of use that they are used for. So when it comes to Hagalah, the first type, with hot water, so the way you would accomplish that with immersing something is to boil up a pot of water to boiling point where it's bubbling. Now, there's a few caveats that really we should address in all types of achsharos before we actually discuss exactly how to accomplish the various forms of achshara. And those caveats are as follows. The kli, the utensil that we are kashering, or the surface that we are kashering, presumably was used also for chametz. And the process that we're using for kashering is very similar to the process of cooking, or the same as the process of cooking. So why is it that this process can take out the chametz, and it's not just being viewed as further cooking in the chametz? Because of that, we have a concept, which is that you, if it's something that you'd want to cook in, it would be considered cooking in. What does that mean, that you'd want to cook in? That means that, that it's something which is fresh, so to speak. So we don't generally kasher 24 hours from when an item was used for cooking, for food preparation. Okay, there might be, you know, minor exceptions. You put something cold down on it, or whatever it was. You didn't really use it. You dropped some, you know, you had some cut up carrots that you dropped into a pot. You didn't cook in it. You didn't do anything with it. Carrots were cold. It was there for, they were dry, relatively dry. They were there for a very short amount of time. It's not really going to create a problem. But if something was properly cooked in, you cook the soup, so you don't just take it, wash it out, and put it back on to kasher it, and you're good to go. We wait generally 24 hours. Again, if you have extenuating circumstances where you can't do it, it's worthwhile asking a rabbi. There might be some sort of way around it, some sort of reason or whatever that we can be a little bit more lenient about. In addition, one of the things that we very often will do is, because maybe there was something that was used or something that was stuck on or whatever it was within the past 24 hours, also there's a concept of something which is called chozer v'neor, that if you have something, when I cook something, even though it was older than 24 hours, and now that I'm warming it up and I'm cooking it, it's refreshing it. I'm turning it into something now which is usable again, because now it's being recooked. So that because of these concepts, what we generally will do, again, if you didn't do it, it will most probably still be okay, is we add in a chomer pogem, something which will blemish the taste of anything that was left behind. So often people will use a little bit of economica, a little bit of bleach or something like that to put in, or a little bit of St. Moritz, but St. Moritz, you have to be careful because it's a lot. It's not, the fumes aren't good. But they generally put it, although when you boil it, what's in there is called something called caustic soda, and caustic soda, when it gets boiled, it's actually not dangerous anymore, the fumes. In fact, pretzels, right? The pretzels that most people eat, they're glossy. You know how they get them glossy? So it's not that egg glaze that you use for your challah at home, and it's not the sugar glaze that they use on the Israeli mezonos rolls. What they do is it goes through on the conveyor belt of the pretzels, between the first and second baking process, it goes through a bath of caustic soda that's being boiled, and that's what gives it its shellac. So, I know that sounds pretty... No. Caustic soda is like St. Moritz. Oven cleaner. Yeah, so you put... Okay. It's fine, because what happens is when it's being evaporated, all the stuff that's toxic, that somehow at the temperature there's a reaction and it loses its toxicity. Nonetheless, I don't recommend putting in a lot of St. Moritz into something that you're kashering, unless you're kashering it outdoors or something like that. Very often the outdoor places in Israel, one of the things that we're very lucky to have is a lot of centers where they kasher for you. There they might put it in, but again, it's a very open outdoor area, and that's fine. But bleach should work, because again, it's not desirable. Even though a minor amount of bleach isn't going to do anything to anything that you're cooking, it's not something which is desirable, and that would suffice. All right. Moving on, now that we have established those caveats, what they are, that you don't want to kasher something within the first 24 hours, additionally, because of negligible amounts and things like that, you should put in some sort of chomer pogem into the hot water when you're kashering with hot water. That does not need to be done for libun, because libun is actually scorching, it's burning out the essence of the chametz and not leaving anything behind, okay? So now, going back to the Hagala. So that's the way you would accomplish it for something that you're putting in the pot. You boil up the pot, you stick the item in. And just for brevity's sake, I'm going to try to take questions at the end. So I see that they put here note pages. Everybody can jot down their questions toch kedei while we're talking. And then at the end, I will try to take as many questions as I can. So you boil up the water in a pot, and then you put the item into, you put the item that you wish to kasher into the pot, obviously not with your bare hands. You should use, either you have to have gloves that are thermal that you can dip in, or you have to have some sort of like pliers or something like that that you can hold it with, you know, very, very steadily and well. And really, the foremost and the most important element of kashering is to make sure that you're doing everything in a way which is safe for you, and you have to be really confident that what you're doing is safe for you. In fact, when we kasher, there are certain things that Chazal, that the rabbi said, we can't kasher. Not because they're not kasherable, but because we're worried that because somebody's going to be nervous that the item's going to break, so they're going to be a little bit stingy on how they kasher it, not do it to its fullest extent, because they're worried the item's going to break. And they won't have accomplished the proper akshar. So Chazal said, you know what? Those items, we don't kasher. So again, make sure that when you're kashering, you're comfortable kashering it yourself, and that you're comfortable kashering the item. Okay, and again, anything that is movable and you can easily take to somewhere where they can kasher, you might as well do it. Give those yeshiva students that are doing it on their break, you know, a few extra shekels, let them enjoy it, and you take a lot of the hassle off of your hands and mind. Okay, now, a countertop you cannot bring to one of those kosher centers. So, what do you do with a countertop? So yes, you can cover the countertops, and maybe it's advisable even if you koshered it, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But in theory, marble countertops and what they call Caesar stone, according to most poskim, the OU poskim also, and actually in the old Pesach guides we say differently, but after we studied it sufficiently, the OU post decided that it's also kasherable. Caesar stone. Mr. Yeshayish Kesav. So Rabbi Belsky Zecharenu Levracha wrote a psak on it that he felt it was kasherable. It's 95% stone, and then there's various other chemicals that are used as a glue compound, basically, and it's cooked at a very low heat. Rabelski felt that it doesn't have a din of cheres and that it could be kashered. So does Rav Landau in Bnei Brak, and the Tzomet has for years given ashgacha on it. When you buy Shayish Kesari, comes with ashgacha from Tzomet. So many posts can maintain that it could be kashered. When you to kasher a countertop, and obviously a stainless steel countertop, if you have like an industrial style counter, that's obviously kasherable as well. So when you kasher a countertop, the way to do it, you can't dip it into any pot either. You can't take it off. It's attached. It's not definitely not advisable. If you do take it off, it will never go back on the same way. And it's too big for a pot. So what you would do is what we call irui mayim roischim, irui mayim rotchim, pouring of boiling water, which is that subdivision that we mentioned at the beginning of Haggalah. But there are certain details that have to be paid very close attention to when using this. Because first of all, you can't just pour any water which is at a technical, you know, close to boiling temperature or something like that. Because boiling means that it was in, that it's the actual kli, that the utensil that was used to boil the water in. It has to be what we call a kli rishon, a kli that was on the fire. Additionally, it has to be mamish, it has to be really still at that boiling temperature. So there are a few ways of accomplishing this. Modern technology has helped us, but again, a lot of caution should be used when using such methods. You used to be, the way people would do this was they would boil up a pot of water. They would take a stone that they would make red hot by leaving it in the fire for a long time. Again, with those melkachayim, with tongs or pliers or whatever, pick up the stone, pour the water, already boiled water over the stone, and that would give it a din of being on the fire, so to speak, at the same time, because it's passing through as the stream is coming down into the counter. It's passing over a burning hot stone, which is like a heating element, and that would give it a din of a kli rishon. Nowadays, we have electronic kumkumim. So as long as the coil is still hot, so use it very quickly. After unplugging it, use it very quickly. Theoretically, you can use it plugged in. Again, that's something that could be very dangerous. It says on the item not to use it that way. So, but if you unplug it, the coil still stays burning hot for a certain amount of time, so it still has the heating element. just like the stone, and you pour it very quickly, and you can kasher in sections. So that you do section A, you see where the water went down directly, not where it spilled onto. Okay, and then you start with kashering again from where the water went down directly, further. So you try to keep a direction. If you see that, you notice that there's a certain area that it didn't go to, because maybe your counters aren't as flat as you were hoping they were. Okay, the installation wasn't perfect. Surprise. Okay, and you might have certain areas, so try to keep track of those and go back. Some people, because of A, maybe they missed a spot during the kashering, and B, if it's real stone, very often there's little crevices in the counter. And especially over time, the first year or two, when it's nicely polished and whatever it is, it's still perfect. The polish is buttle, you don't have to worry about that. It's null. It's considered part of the stone because it's such a minimal amount. So we view it as becoming part of the stone. Okay? Similar to the glue in the Caesar stone. And so that's not a problem. So you could theoretically have it maybe polished before. There are some poskim that don't like that because they say we know chametz went in before it was repolished. So when you repolish it, it's not good. But maybe after you kasher as an extra protection, you can have it repolished. It's a nice thing to do anyway. If I was speaking to husbands, I'd say it's a nice thing to do for your wife. But anyway, so you can, it's a nice thing to do. You know, have your counters refreshed, but it can, you know, cost a little bit of money. And you want it done properly, because if it's not done properly, it can look horrible. Anyway, that being said, so because of those crevices that might be hard to clean out, and because some people feel that maybe they missed some spots or whatever it is, and they're being, you know, a little bit obsessive about Pesach kashering, so a lot of people will cover their counters. The crevices isn't such an obsessiveness. Worrying that you missed a spot might be. But nonetheless, a lot of people do cover their counters, because of that reason, and you know, even though they kashered it, they might be a little bit more lenient about how they cover their counters if they kashered it. For mica, counters cannot really be kashered. There might be other types of surfaces, but most of the surfaces that are used here in Israel are either real marble or Shayesh Chevroni, or Shayesh Kesari, sorry, the Caesar stone. Shayesh Chevroni is real marble. That it's a real marble. It's very soft, so it has a lot of crevices. But it's a real marble. there are other items that we won't use Haggala for, even though they technically should work a Haggala, which would be something that has lots of little holes in it. So we assume that the little holes can't be kashered. There are some people who don't kasher forks for that reason, but halachically forks can be kashered. It's just something which would be maybe like a strainer or something like that. We wouldn't kasher, even though it's all metal, so theoretically it should be able to be kashered. You'd be able to kasher it. Now, so what's the difference between a pot that we would do Haggala on and maybe some sort of thing that we wouldn't, that we would have to use a libun? So we use libun for items that are used dry, meaning that there's no liquid on it. So because there's no liquid, it's used in the fire, so to speak. There's fire on one side or very strong heat of some sort on one side. There's food on the other side. So it's considered, we view it that it got burnt into the item, so to speak. So to get it out, the pasuk says you have to burn it out. An item that came into direct contact with the food, generally we will require, if assuming again that it was dry food, we will require a libun chamer for, which means the full extent scorching, which we'll get to in a second what the difference is. Something which was used maybe like an oven, where we're not kashering because anything touched the oven. It was maybe dry, but really what we're worried about is the avir, the evaporation of various things in the oven. Aside from Moshe Feinstein, who maintained that an oven needs to be kashered with libun chamer, all the other major poskim felt that it sufficed to kasher an oven with what we call libun kal. A self-clean oven will reach libun chamer. Again, we'll talk about exactly what a libun chamer is in a second. The more massive libun, the more massive scorching. Whereas a regular oven that does not have a self-clean mode, like most ovens here in Israel, will not reach libun chamer, but you'll be able to accomplish on it what we refer to as a libun kal, a more minor scorching of the oven. I mean, you could always do a libun chamer by taking a blowtorch, but you'll likely break your oven, and it's not really so safe unless you have a very long-armed blowtorch to blowtorch an oven. So again, you have your safety, and since you might break the oven, you know, they're made with all sorts of different parts that can't withstand such heat because they're only meant to go up to 200, 250 degrees Celsius. So they're not really made to withstand heat of 400 plus Celsius. So those are items that we will kasher with a libun kal. Additionally, an item that could have been kasher with a hagala, with just putting into immersing in the boiling water, you could generally also use a libun kal for. So in other words, if you have a pot that you make soup in, but for whatever reason you already have your blowtorch out and you don't want the mess of boiling water or whatever it is, so you theoretically could blowtorch that pot, again assuming it's material that could withstand the heat of a libun kal even. So the way libun kal is measured is that if you would put a piece of paper on the other side of the pot, really it says kash, but paper would be the same shear. So you can take a little piece of masking tape, right, that off-white paper tape, you put it, or like a paper sticker or something like that, you put it on the other side of the item that you're doing a libun kal to, and you'd blowtorch it, and you'd see that the other side, that the tape, that paper on the other side starts to get scorched, you know you accomplished a libun kal, a more minor scorching. A more massive scorching, a major scorching, would be accomplished by making the item red hot or making nitzotzot, making like spark out of the item. Most metals nowadays don't have, because of the aluminum that's put into it, etc., that's mixed into it at least, won't have those characteristics. You won't get it to, you'll never get a metal pan to turn, even the one that you put in your oven for broiling purposes, it's not going to become red hot. It will withstand very strong heat. You can heat it up to 500 degrees Celsius or 700 degrees Celsius perhaps even, but it's not going to turn red hot. It's not going to spark either. If I remember correctly though, if it reaches close to 400 degrees Celsius, that would already be sufficient for a libun chamer. Okay, so those are the shiurim for libun chamer. Again, for additional guidance with how these different items can be kashered, you can reference the guide that was printed in front of you. You can also look online for a more updated version of the guide that might have a few other items. Oh, so here actually the kosher countertops, here it says they have an old article that says that you can't kasher Caesar stone, but you could kasher Caesar stone. So that's revoked. Okay, I'll say it again just to make it very clear since it's printed. You could kasher Caesar stone, even though the article explains why it can't be kashered. After being reviewed in greater depth, we feel that it could be kashered. Okay, now I want to talk now about products and certifications and statements and declarations and ashkachos, etc. Can I take all the questions at the end, or can I take the questions at the end just so I can? Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. When we go to the supermarket, especially in Israel and America already also, there's declarations about kitniot, which technically means legumes. So probably anybody in the room from Ashkenazi background is familiar what that means precisely. That at some point in time, there was a Ashkenazi takana, an enactment by the Ashkenazi Rabbanim for a dual purpose, sometimes because it was actually chametz that came in close proximity and there was cross-contamination, so there was chametz mixed into the items. Additionally, it was items that you could make something that would be mistaken as chametz from. They said such items should not be consumed on Pesach. So a typical example for something like that would be something like corn and corn flour. Okay, because corn and corn flour, they would often grow next to the grains, so they would sometimes be mixed in with the kernels, some wheat kernels. So you think that it's all corn flour, but there's a little bit of wheat flour in that corn flour. Okay, That's one issue. And the other issue is that you make cornbread and it looks exactly like bread and people might confuse it with bread. So you're going to tell me nowadays we can make out of potato flour and everything like that, whatever, without eating gebrucks, without talking about, we'll talk about gebrucks in a second, without eating shuya, without eating gebrucks, you can still make any cake, any bread. They sell rolls kosher lePesach already, not just homemade recipes and tricks or whatever it is. You can buy them already made. They look decent. They taste okay. And so it could already be done. So I'll tell you something interesting, which was actually the Chaye Adam of Danziger, who was the Rav in Vilna during the time of the Vilna Gaon. He wanted to forbid potato starch, potatoes and potato starch. And the Pnei Yeshua, who was a Rav in Germany at the time, wrote him a letter that if you, I think it was the Pnei Yeshua, that if you forbid potatoes, you're going to be forbidding Chaye Adam, right, the life of man, which is the name of his sefer. So it was a play on words. He got the idea, and he did not make an enactment, so to speak, against consuming potatoes or potato starch on Pesach. In fact, I'll tell you a very interesting story, which was my great-great-grandfather, twice, Rabbi Leo Feinstein, Rabbi Prozhane. He was the Rav in Prozhane, and a small town in Belarus. And as it would very often go, you'd have a count or a countess that owned most of the property that the Jews would rent the property from. And she was anti-Semitic. So she bought a crew of dogs, that she would release always at the time that the man would be leaving the shul. Like, you know, ferocious dogs. And she came to watch it. And she saw it was working excellently. All of a sudden, Beliyahu Feinstein, Beliyahu Prozhane walked out and the dogs stopped and they were silent. So she was so impressed by it, she came over to him and said, "Wow, you know, what's going on here? These are ferocious dogs." He says, "I don't know." But she saw that the dogs were in awe from him. So she said, "You know what? I want to do something for the Jewish community. What can I do?" And this was about Purim time. So he said, "You can buy potatoes for the whole community." So from then on, the way the tale goes is that she bought potatoes every year. She sponsored potatoes for the whole community of Prozhane. So I heard this story from Michal Feinstein, Zichrono Livracha, nephew of my great-great-grandfather, and he said that he was actually in Prozhane during those years that they got potatoes. So he said, Eidosi testified to the story being true. So kitnios, though, back to kitnios. Kitnios are any of those items that come from legumes that, again, grow or are stored in close proximity to wheat and other prohibited grain products. And are confusable on some level with wheat or wheat products. So there's been a lot of discussions about all sorts of products. Obviously, corn they had in Europe, and corn was something that it's understandable why they would have such an enactment on. But there's all sorts of other beans and nuts and different things that maybe some people or a lot of people don't consume. And you say it's kind of like, you know, something maybe that they didn't have there. So there is a lot of discussion about what exactly goes into this minhag, if you want to refer to it as that, enactment, if you want to refer to it as that, of not consuming kitnios. So Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote a tshuva, and he said that whatever was around, and whatever was mikubal, was accepted as being in this, so to speak, prohibition, this customary prohibition of kitnios, that's what stands. But nothing new stands, something which is a new world food, even not new world to us, but new world to the newcomers to America, like maybe peanuts or something like that, that wouldn't go into the problem. Peanuts did become something that was very generally accepted by almost everybody, you know, cross community wise. And so most people won't have peanuts. The OU will not certify peanuts or peanut oil or anything like that, which we'll get to also the oils in a second. Okay. So that's the general idea about kitnios. The OU used to not certify items like quinoa, And in recent years, the OU changed their position on it and has started to certify. It doesn't mean that all the OU poskim changed their view. There are still those that say that it's better not to consume quinoa, and we'll get to that in a second. There are those that explain, Rabbi Belsky, Zichrono Livracha, used to explain Rav Moshe's tshuva as not referring to items that fit the bill for kitnios. It's items that don't fit the bill, but maybe for some reason still, you know, some people want to be makbid on. Like peanuts. Because peanuts don't fit the bill because you don't make products out of it. They're generally not stored with wheat. But it's a legume like many of the other legumes that were included in the kitnios prohibition. So therefore, because peas were something that in Europe they were makbid on, and peanuts grow in a similar process, in a similar fashion to peas. That's why they're called peanuts. They're really in the pea family and they're not in the nut family. That's why we make on it ha'adama, not ha'eitz. So something like that doesn't fit the bill per se, but because it's similar to other things that were considered kitnios, that's why a lot of people view it as kitnios. So that's where there might be room to argue that this is a new world food. But something like quinoa, which is a grain, and it can be used, you can make a flour out of it, even though most people use it more for, you know, to boil it and make salads out of it or dishes out of it and that type of thing. But it could be, you could make a bread out of it. Additionally, there's reason to be concerned that maybe it grows next to wheat because it grows in similar conditions, similar climates and similar conditions, etc. So these poskim would read Rav Moshe's tshuva not to exclude something like quinoa from the prohibition of kitnios, but rather to include it because it fits the bill for what should be kitnios. So the OU, before they changed their position, one of the things they did was review the growing process and the areas, etc., where quinoa grow, and they felt that there wasn't a significant chash, there wasn't a significant fear of it being grown in close proximity to wheat or being necessarily processed in the same place. We will not certify quinoa as OUP if it was processed in the same plant, even if they cleaned in between, as wheat for this reason. That was one of the conditions, so to speak, given to the quinoa that the OU will certify. Because of that, there was a discussion amongst the OU poskim. It was decided that the OU would certify it. If somebody does not want to consume it, they definitely shouldn't. There's reason to be you know, a little bit more scrupulous about it. But again, it's a minog, yeshal mal lismoch, the OU certifying it right now. It's perfectly fine to consume it if somebody wishes to rely on those poskim. And again, you know, it's something which is really based on a minhag. It's not something that's based on halacha. It's not a chashis or dorais. It's not like you have to be worried that you're going to transgress some sort of biblical prohibition or anything like that. It's much further removed. Sephardi jury, on the whole, did not accept any of the kitnios. Some of the Moroccan communities actually do have at least partial minhagim as per kitnios. I think there are also some others, various Sephardi communities, more particular, like cities or whatever it is, where they were makabel the kitnios. It's the Abu Chatzera family is makbid on kitnios. So there are various Sephardi communities that are particular about kitnios, or at least various types of kitnios. Now, there's another concept, which is yotze mea kitnios. What about something which isn't the kitnios itself, and it's not a flour, it's not something I'm going to make a bread out of, but an oil? So the word poskim wanted to be lenient about it. Most of the major poskim didn't see a reason to be mechalek, to differentiate between something which is yotze mea kitnios, like an oil, like a juice that comes out of the kitnios, or the kitnios itself, and therefore will not use something like soy oil or various other oils that can't come out of something which are deemed to be kitnios. We'll get to now. So just talk about canola oil for a second. I know that a lot of people want to know about canola oil. Canola seems to be a new world food. Whoever heard about canola 100 years ago in Europe, certainly nobody had canola. That's true and not 100% true. Why is it not 100% true? Because canola, or rapeseed, right? While rapeseeds weren't used for anything in Europe, rapeseeds grew, and rapeseeds are part of the mustard family. if you see them on some of the bottles of canola oil here in Israel that you buy, there's little pictures of the yellow flowers, and it looks very similar to mustard. So Rabbi Belsky, Zecharon Lavracha, felt that since it's part of the mustard family, true, it's a more bitter version that isn't used regularly in food production. In fact, canola oil was originally created as a crude oil, and then afterwards it was discovered that it can be refined and used as a food-grade oil with less saturated fat and all sorts of other, you know, so to speak, dietary benefits. So it's become a very popular oil, especially because then you're not using the rape seeds for anything else, and they can grow very well, almost wildly, just like a lot of the mustard varieties. So therefore, it's a relatively cheap option of oil that has relatively good qualities as far as oil is concerned for cooking purposes, for both health-wise and taste-wise. But because of that, Rybelski felt that it's the same exact thing as all other kitnios, because it's part of the mustard family, and mustard was one of the things that's mentioned by the poskim as being kitnios, by the early Ashkenazic poskim as being considered kitnios. Therefore, he said, you know, that's like a prime example of kitnios, and it should not be used on Pesach. What time? Until what time do I have? I'll keep it going. Okay. So that's the story with the canola oil. Now, there's another concept which is called kitnios shenishtanu, which actually people talk about it also with regard to chametz shenishtanu. Now, what does that mean, chametz shenishtanu or kitnios shenishtanu? Right. So there are those that would say that would apply such a term to even something like yotzei min hakitnios, something, you know, like the oils. No, you won't, and I think most poskim don't. Where it is applied often to is something that went through some sort of process, a biochemical process, so to speak. I'll give a very quick example, and I'm going to say it in the most simple form possible. Citric acid, which is something which is used in so many food items, okay, people might use it for cooking. It's actually found naturally in lemons, hence the name citric acid in most citrus fruit. In tomatoes also, there's citric acid naturally. So the way it's created, though, industrially, is that you let bacteria feed off of some sort of sugar medium, and what they put out, what they consume one thing, and they release something else in turn. What the bacteria are releasing is citric acid. I said in the simplest form possible. Okay? So that there, if you take a sugar, let's say, which is corn syrup, you take a corn sugar, and you allow the bacteria to feed off of the corn sugar, and now they release that citric acid from the corn sugar. So right now, that was something, it went through a process. To the eye, it looks like you put in one thing and you got something else, to the naked eye. But we know that there was a real process there, that something made a change, because it was bacteria that ate one thing and released the other thing. Because of that, and it's a multi-stage process that takes 7 days industrially to create citric acid, because of that process, There are many poskim that will be more lenient on something like that, because I'll say it's kitnios shenishtanu. When it's chametz, it's much more difficult to say such a thing, because on the one, you had chametz, so what changed the chametz to something else? Therefore, the poskim are not lenient when it comes to chametz. When it comes to kitnios, there are poskim that are lenient about kitnios shenishtanu. Over time, it's become less and less necessary to rely on this in industry, because there were certain products, especially some of the substitute sweeteners that were based on a similar type of chemical process as the citric acid. But over time, we found methods to have created all these things without needing to use even kitnios shenishtanu. There's less and less and less of that being used by any of the major ashkachos over time, because it's less necessary to use it. The problem, though, with many of the items that are often kitnios shenishtanu is that very often they can also be made from chametz shenishtanu, because wheat will also have in it some sugar that will be a byproduct of whatever of the stuff that you take out of the wheat to produce the flour, etc. And that could also be used as a medium to grow many of these other types of citric acid, artificial sweeteners, etc. Therefore, you know, even for kidney shenishtanu, we would need to ascertain that it's kidney shenishtanu and not chametz shenishtanu. It would need a significant amount of supervision, of kashrus supervision, to make sure that it was okay, even on that level. I'm going to take very soon the questions. When you see something here in Israel where it says liftit is lecithin. Lecithin would go into the same category as any oils. It was a way to work around the fact that in various industries it was hard for them to substitute lecithin. So they, instead of writing lochle kitniot, which they do if they use soy oil, and it's not any different than soy oil, so they write lochle liftit. So some people say, okay, I don't know, I never heard that. I don't eat liftit, so they buy it. It's the same exact thing as any other yotzeima kitnios. Okay, so that's Aleph Beis Gimel. Now, that's ABC. And what we'll say again on the kitnios is like this, is that there's a din of bittul on kitnios, which means that you can nullify kitnios on Pesach. Halach l'maisa, in Shulchan Aruch, there are Ma, Rav Moshe Isserles, the premier posik for Ashkenazi Jewry, writes that you can be mevatel kitnios l'chatchilo on Pesach. We don't do that generally nowadays. Most poskim say that you shouldn't. And the reason for that is because since kitnios became something that wasn't around really on Pesach for most people in the Ashkenazi Jewry again, it became something that they didn't use at all. And so they say it kind of took on a dimension of being viewed as a chametz, like by minhag. Therefore, most poskim will say don't nullify it on Pesach, lechatchila, if it happened, very often don't be makel about it, because then I can view it worse as an iser derabbanan, as a rabbinic prohibition, because it's not even that, but they still won't tell you to go ahead and mix it in on Pesach. This is particularly pertinent to those who have young infants that they give them Materna or other formulas, or to people who take Ensure, or this now Tenuva came out with a similar product, I forgot what it's called. So that's particular to those types of items, because this kitnios, that's why it will say to wash it in a separate sink or something like that. That's the reason for it, so that it shouldn't get mixed into other stuff that are going on in the kitchen over Pesach. Use special spoons, etc. There it's also powder, so the bittul is a little bit more significant until at least it's made into the liquid form. Going on to medications, to talk about medications very quickly. Medications, when there's a non-chametz option, so obviously it's better to take a non-chametz option. If it's a prescription medication, one should never make changes to their medications unless they know it's really for something totally benign that they're taking it. You know, they have slight allergies, or they have slight this, slight that, whatever it is, and they take it on their own whim. It's not something that they're taking, you know, regularly for a real health issue. If it's a real health issue, make sure to talk to your doctor before you decide not to take it on Pesach. There are hotlines. Eid HaRedes has a hotline. The various Kupot Cholim has a hotline, where you have hotlines where you can call up to find out if your medications are kosher for Pesach, or if there's a kosher Pesach alternative that you can go to the pharmacy and ask for. If it's not, so it's always best to take it in a way that's least comparable to an eating, to manner of eating. That's, you know, the vitamins is a little bit more complicated, because something you're taking as a dietary supplement, okay? So it's usually taken not as a reaction to something, a medication. Ray Belsky felt the difference between a dietary supplement and a medication is something that I'm taking because I have an issue that I need to heal myself from, and this is the remedy, be it from a laboratory or be it from nature, but this is the remedy for the sickness. Okay, or if it's something that I want to boost my immune system, I want to feel stronger, I want to feel more energetic, or something like that, or I don't want to get, you know, it's the winter, you know, I don't want to get a cold, so I'm taking more vitamin C, I'm boosting, I'm taking zinc, I'm taking iron, I'm taking all sorts of things to boost my immune system. That's a dietary supplement, because really, if you ate enough food with whatever the, you know, you ate enough oranges and you ate enough, you ate enough red meat with the iron in it. I'm not talking about the cholesterol right now, but you ate enough of whatever products contain that nutrient, you'd be fine also. You're taking it instead of food, not because you're sick and you need to heal yourself, but because you want to make sure to stay healthy and you don't want to eat red meat. You don't want to eat oranges or whatever else. So when you take it for that type of reason, that would be a dietary supplement. And even swallowing might be considered then to be a form of eating, because there are things that we generally swallow, like drinks, and there are things that even if you, you know, while you're eating, you might swallow a little bit before. It's more chewed or less chewed or whatever it is. And therefore, you know, there might be an element of eating even to swallowing, and it's best to try to avoid that when one can. So with dietary supplements, it's definitely worthwhile asking a, you know, if it's something that you decide to take, to ask at least a competent halachic authority if it's okay for you, if it's not a, if it's a chametz issue or not. And if there is some sort of chametz or issue or something like that, to ask them, you know, if you think you really need it for whatever reason, to explain to them why you need it. Maybe they'll send you to a medical professional to have that verified, but to make sure that it's really something that you need before you use it. Again, things that are only kidneys and are important to somebody, which might be a dietary supplement like Ensure, but it's very important to the person who's taking it because they can't eat other things, or it's very difficult for them to eat other things or to get the nutrition they need from the things that they can eat. So that's a different story. They should continue taking it then if that's their regular diet, even though it's kidneys, because those items are only kidneys. Again, if you want an exact list, you can get the OU's list online. You can. There might be some paper copies in the Israel Center. I don't know if they received them yet, of the printed out lists from the OU. But it's worthwhile to check into those things. Now we will take questions. Okay. I know you wanted to ask a question a while back. It can't, the question was that it says in the guide that a glass top stove can't really be kosher, and it tells you how to use it by raising it with, by putting some sort of metal, you know, insert or whatever you want to call it, put a metal grate on top of the glass top stove, between the glass top stove, say that 10 times fast, and the pot. So the answer is because, right, it cannot be kashered. That's why you need to put something else in between. Because if you usually during the year, you wouldn't necessarily put that in between surface. Because you're not kashering it, so we say you can still use it even though it wasn't kashered, provided there's no mamashos, there's no substantial chametz, there's nothing that's real, you cleaned it off well, and you raise it so that the pot's not touching the surface, that has the bliot, that has the absorption of chametz in it. It was raised with that kosher LePesach ring, and it's sitting only on the ring, then you'd be allowed to use it.
So you can use it.
Right.
Why is it that diet sodas, like Coke, Diet Coke, for Pesach is all right in the United States, you can get kosher LePesach with a good hefzer, but here in Israel, you can only get it with the Rabbanot.
Okay, so that... The question was, how come there are diet sodas in America that are certified by the major American Hashgachos, and over here it goes down from the Mahadran Hashgachos, and Pesach goes down from the Mahadran Hashgachos to regular Rabbanot? You can ask, if you want, we'll send you a printout of our Tuda. You can buy the Diet Coca-Cola, Coke Zero, Diet Sprite Zero, whatever they call it over here, and the regular varieties of diet soda from the Coca-Cola company in Israel are certified by the OU. If it has the Rabbanot on it, it's certified by us, and you can use it for Pesach if you'd be comfortable with that in America.
What? Okay, for kashering, do you use a chametz pot or a Pesach pot?
I've read both.
Okay, the question was when you kasher, so you're boiling the water to do the hag'ala in, to be able to dip, to immerse the other utensils into, should you use a Pesach pot or a chametz pot? The answer is you can use either. If you're planning on using the pot for Pesach, when you finish doing the kashering, you should make sure that the water goes over the sides of that pot before you continue to use that pot for Pesach. Okay, I think the question was how long do you put on the self-clean oven before to kasher the oven? A self-clean oven, you put on a self-clean cycle, and that's sufficient. No, you don't have to do extra. Okay, I think the question was, can you kasher a plata, the Shabbos hot plate, for Pesach? What I recommend doing is to kasher it is difficult because it doesn't really reach a high enough temperature to kasher. And you would ruin it by torching it or something like that because there's an electric heating element inside it. What you could do is triple wrap with aluminum foil. The reason why triple wrap, double wrap would really be sufficient, but very often it's going to rip off in the middle, and then check it before every additional use. Every time you use it again after the first day of Yom Tov, check it before the last days, that, you know, maybe rewrap it or put an extra layer again before the last day this year, days of Yom Tov, even in Eretz Yisrael, to make sure that it's fully wrapped. Clean it first. Just want to give fair attention to the sides. Okay, so we discussed that before. I think actually in the Torah Tidbits, they printed a little blurb about it. They're not sure if it's available. Oh, sorry, Kinwa for Pesach. The Kinwa for Pesach. So the question is if it's available in Israel to an OUP. And the answer is that we're not sure if it's available. We don't sell it ourselves, so we only certify it. We don't know if any of the ones that we've certified have been brought to Israel. Yes. Okay, the question was that if kashering is really for items that were heated, so a refrigerator which was always cold, if it's cleaned out sufficiently, why do you have to cover it? The answer is that you do not have to cover it. Many people cover it, again, because they want to make sure maybe there's something left in the crevices, maybe something spilled there and something's going to spill there again. All sorts of, you know, more far-fetched types of reasons. Mi'ikar ad-din, from a strictly halachic perspective, you do not need to cover your fridge. Okay, the question was if kinwa needs special hashkacha for Pesach. We do say that it should have special shkach for Pesach, both because since there is some sort of chash and in some places it might grow next to wheat, we want it to be checked to verify that there isn't wheat mixed into it, Aleph, A, and B, we want to make sure that in the processing plant where they're packaging it, they're not packaging on the same line other grains, because that would be a bigger issue. Sorry. Rapeseed. R-A-P-E-S-E-E-D. It's for those who do not consume kitnios, then it should be viewed as kitnios, correct?
Now, as far as medications are concerned, are they considered food on Pesach, and therefore you have to check what's in them, and
okay, I think the question is why is there a if I understand what you're asking, is you're asking why is medication an issue on Pesach if it's not a food item? So again, medication you're taking only for medicinal purposes, okay? That it would not be considered medicine. Therefore, strictly speaking, it's permitted to take it on Pesach because that's what's defining over here. In other words, the same pu'ula, the same action of swallowing could be an action of taking food, or it can be an action of taking medicine. When it's strictly medicinal, then it's permitted to take on Pesach. However, because it's chametz and you're being nehneh, you're benefiting from the chametz, if there's an alternative that's not chametz, it's better to take the non-chametz alternative. If it's something which is, again, like a dietary supplement, it might be considered, according to some poskim, to be a form of eating when you swallow. So you don't have ana, you don't make a bracha on it, etc. But there's some sort of element of eating to it, and therefore they feel that it should be avoided as well.
Me?
Yeah. The pump?
The pump, yeah. So you just, I was one that has like stainless steel, not the plastic one. So I heard different things that you can wipe it down and use it on Pesach. What's your
opinion? Okay, I don't think it's a matter of opinion. I'm going to speak in the name of halacha on this item. Okay? And the question was that the Shabbos kumkumim, particularly she's asking about the pump versions. Okay, but I don't know that it's really actually different between the pump version and the non-pump version. Theoretically, if all you're using it for is to pour out hot water from it and you're not cooking with it, you're not putting any chametz, so all you put in it was water, it doesn't really need to be kashered. However, it sits around the kitchen all year round. Therefore, A, you want to make sure that it's very clean before you use it, and B, it's suggested to, yes, do a form of kashering. If there's plastic pieces, so Moshe Feinstein, Zichrono Levracha, felt that was lenient on kashering plastic for year-round purposes, meaning from meat to dairy or dairy to meat, but not when it came to Pesach from chametz to not chametz. Okay? In such an item, again, where it's only a chshash, it's only that you're worried that maybe this, you have a minimal doubt that maybe sometime, somehow, some chametz splashed on it when it was hot, but it's not generally how it's used. It's not how it's supposed to be used. So in such circumstances, most of the poskim would allow kashering even the plastic parts, and that should be accomplished by leaving it, again, out of use for 24 hours and pouring through it and over it some hot water, again, directly from a kli rishon. You had a question? Okay, so you're asking that you put on top of the urn,
but it's wrapped.
Usually, you often warm up your challah on top of the urn, but it's usually wrapped.
It's wrapped.
Yeah, no, so even if it wouldn't be wrapped, I don't know that would necessarily be the biggest issue, because you can put your hand usually on top of the, if it's a plastic top, you definitely can put, if it's a metal top, so you can kasher it. You just stick it into the boiling water, into a bigger pot, and have them kasher the top. If it's a plastic top, then usually it won't reach Yad Soledes Bo on the outside. You can usually put your hand on top. Okay? But even if it was double wrapped, then it should certainly be okay. And then again, but you might as well kasher it, something that's around the kitchen. It's better to kasher it. Again, nowadays we live in a generation where things are relatively cheap. And very often, every so often you're going to have to replace it anyway. So many people will opt, instead of kashering, instead of worrying if it's clean, and instead of feeling like maybe I didn't do my maximum, many people will still opt to buy one for Pesach. And then they know that they have a reserve, so when Erev Shabbos, they take it out, and they see that the guf chimum, the heating element in their Shabbos urn, went. They have the reserve one from Pesach. They go climb in or climb up to wherever the Pesach one is stored, take it out. Ala makom, instantly they have their way out of that Erev Shabbos catastrophe.
We have a question over here also.
Okay, sorry.
Under 3
can an under three, the question was, can an under 3-year-old eat kitnios? I don't know if the age would be 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I don't know that necessarily makes a difference. There's a concept in halacha which is that it's permissible to feed a child in Iser Derabanan Biyadayim, which means that if something's prohibited only from rabbinic purposes, most often it's referred to with issues of Bishul Akum, of food that's cooked, that's kosher technically, but it was cooked by a non-Jew, so is there a rabbinic enactment not to eat that food, that you would be able to serve it to a minor, or to be able to serve food that's mukta for some reason, however it became mukta without getting to that conversation, that you can feed that to a minor on Shabbos. Chinuch comes from the age that a child is able to comprehend it. It has nothing to do with an exact age. There are certain mitzvos that we say there's a certain amount of time that a child needs to become accustomed before they're obligated in the mitzvah. So there are certain mitzvos that we say maybe from age 9 or from the year before the bar or bas mitzvah that they should start keeping. When we talk about teaching them what not to do and what to do, so it's a Ramban in the beginning of Parshas Emor, and many of the Rishonim talk about it in different areas. That chinuch, and we see it by the mitzvah of Hakel, that once a child is old enough to be able to go up with their father should take them up. When a child's old enough to be able to leave his mother, he doesn't need to. He's already weaned. He doesn't need a mother anymore, right? There was no materna in those days. So you can the father is obligated to take his son with him to the Beis Hamikdash for Aliyah LeRegel. So we see even at a very young age, there's a mosik, there's a concept of chinuch. To teach your kids what we do and what we don't do, what our customs are and aren't, starts from a very young age. But if a child needs to eat and what's available right then is kitnios, and you don't have, you're on a trip, you didn't bring enough food, something happened to the food, water spilled all over everything, got ruined, whatever it is, and all they're selling there is bamba, right, or whatever it is, which is both corn and peanuts and all the kidneys together, no chametz, but all the kidneys together, and it's made in canola oil or soy oil, right, so it's got all the kidneys in there together. And that's all there is to give him, and he's really hungry. You don't have to make your kids suffer, and you'd be able to give it to him, even probably if he's a little bit older. He might be old enough that he's going to say, I don't want to do it because it's wrong. I know you don't do it, right? You know that the whole idea of letting a child turn on or off a light on Shabbos, right? That people know about it, and they've heard it. You can't do. It's the Chaya Adam is where it comes from. The Chaya Adam says if you have a stain on your outfit, on the Shabbos, that same chayal that we talked about with the potatoes. So he says that what you're able to do is to allow the child to play with the fabric to remove the stain. Because he doesn't have in mind, he's not doing it to clean it. So likewise, you can take a child and place him next to the light switch. Because little children play with things. They play with buttons, right? They have all these toys with buttons that they press and things pop out and whatever it is. So they're playing, and they don't realize that there's anything wrong with that. The second your child comes back from Gan, and he learned that it's muktzah, it's not muktzah, it's a malacha, to turn on and off the light. But the second they come back from Gan, having learned that that's a problem, or the second they picked up on it, right? You know that your kid says, but it's Shabbos when you put them next to the light. So they know that what you want them to do is turn on or off the light. And you know, and they already know that that's something you don't do on Shabbos, so you're not allowed to do that because now you're messing up your kid's chinuch. Okay? Beforehand, if they don't understand that, then that is okay because you're letting them play and you happen to derive benefit from what they accomplished through their games. Okay, I think we have to end. I'll take just these two last questions.